Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts. Today I'm sitting in for Diane while she's on vacation. The smell and taste of a soup, a stew, a cookie can transport us to other times and places. A longtime foreign correspondent for Forbes magazine says that food also can bridge deep cultural divides. Richard Moraes set his debut novel in the kitchens and markets of India and France. The title is The 100-Foot Journey, and Richard Moraes joins us in the studio to talk about this novel, about his career as a foreign correspondent, and anything that's on your mind. So, Richard, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a great honor to be here.
You can join us at 1-800-433-8850, drshow@wamu.org, and talk to Richard about your own food experiences, your own connections between food and memory and place, and I'm sure many of you have many tales to share with Richard. But I want to start with this question. You were a journalist your whole life for Forbes, and this is a business publication. You wrote countless articles for them. Many journalists like you dream about becoming a novelist. I worked at the New York Times. The old line was half the people in the city room had a half-finished novel, you know, in the drawer of their desk. How hard was it for you to make this transition?
Very hard. When my daughter was born 20 years ago, I made a promise. I realized that life was short, and I made a promise to myself that before I started my day job every morning, I would write a little bit of fiction. And Forbes was very tolerant in that when I was Forbes' European bureau chief and was there for 17 years, and I refused to go to an office. And they were very tolerant of my eccentricities, and so the time I saved commuting, I devoted to fiction. So that's how it all started.
That started 20 years ago, but this is your first novel to be published.
One of the things that Forbes taught us was to write short. Chief executives are very busy, and we're all very busy, and you have to quickly get to the point. So one of the greatest problems I had was getting over my length issue. And so this actually started as a novella. It was a semi-finalist in a William Faulkner writing competition. Then HarperCollins India bought it, and I did a book tour of India. And in that novella form, I did a book tour of India, which was an extraordinary experience. Only the second time I had been in India. And then after that, Scribner bought it here in the U.S., and it's now sold in 16 territories around the world, and the film rights have gone. So it really was I am engaged in my own kind of 100-foot journey of looking for artistic fulfillment.
But why did you what appealed to you about sort of stealing this time from Forbes every morning? You mentioned the birth of your daughter, but what was it about your job? What was it about your sensibility that said, I want to take some time to try something different?
Well, this particular book, it really was started because when I was a young man, I wrote an article about Ismail Merchant of Merchant Ivory Productions. And Ismail was the film producer behind those lovely films, Howard's End, Remains of the Day, Room with a View, that came out in the 80s and 90s. And Ismail, over the years, he and I became friends, and he was a great cook. And they always said that the term, Simon Callow, the actor, used to say the term curry favor was invented for Ismail because he would, when he wanted something from you, and he invariably wanted something from you, he would cook for you and overwhelm you. And
with curry.
With curry, exactly. And so one day, he showed me a lovely film that he had directed. It was Anita Desai's In Custody, and it was in Urdu. And afterwards, we were eating in the Bombay Brasserie, and I said, in London, and I said, you know, Ismail, you really need to find a literary property that marries your love of food with your love of filmmaking. And I said, I'll help you find something. And I thought I'd find a real writer like Balzac, you know, to hand him. But I never found exactly what I was looking for. So one day, my wife and daughter and I, we were walking on a beach, and the idea popped into my head. So that was really the germ. And it was a very sort of superficial, original motivation, is that I wanted him to make the film of what I've written.
You had originally said, you know, you should find something else.
Exactly.
And then you said, I'll do it myself.
Because I never could find exactly what I was looking for.
And of course, there have been novels, that are deeply rooted in the food culture or food sensibility. Chocolat is a good example of it.
And a very good point. The thing is that Ismail was an Indian of Muslim descent, and that is what my main character is. So I was really doing something very bespoke for Ismail.
But you are not an Indian
of
Muslim descent. You're of Portuguese descent, raised in Switzerland. Fill in your background for our listeners.
My mother's family are WASP New Yorkers, and my father's family are of Portuguese descent. My grandfather was the Portuguese consul general in Norway, where my dad was born, and then in the middle of the war, they were transferred to Newfoundland, when Newfoundland was still independent from Canada. And then my father came of age in Canada and became a Canadian citizen. And in the 50s, my father worked for Alcan, and they were sent to Portugal and Spain to build their operations there. And so my brothers and I were all born in Portugal and Spain. I'm the youngest of four boys. And I was born in Lisbon, Portugal. And at the age of 10 months old, we moved to Switzerland, to Zurich. In those days, Switzerland was the only country that had free capital flows. So all the multinationals put their European headquarters there so they could repatriate their profits back to the U.S. and Canada. So we moved there, and I was there for 16 years and until I went to Sarah Lawrence. And I was an American who was born abroad. I went to British and American schools in Switzerland, but I had never lived in America. And at the age of 16, I went to Sarah Lawrence, and I didn't feel American either.
Sure.
I wasn't European and I wasn't American. I was in this very sort of, it's a difficult, being a teenager is difficult under the best of circumstances.
Under the best of circumstances.
Right. So I felt this great alienation, and I had the privilege of studying with Grace Paley, the short story writer. And Grace wrote from the tradition of the, Jewish Bronx. And she walked into class one day and she said, "The reason we write is to show how we're different from people." And I remember I was 19 at the time, and I put up my hand, and my voice was shaking, and I said, "Grace, I think that is the most irresponsible thing I've ever heard a teacher say." I said, "I know I'm different. I know I feel my alienation from other people all the time. The reason I write is to find what I have in common with other people." And so so on the superficial level, I wanted to write something for Ismail. But on another level, my first love was acting, and my approach into fiction is through acting. I wanted to write in a character completely different from my background.
Well, that's what leads directly into my next question. By the way, I'm talking to Richard Moraes. His book is The 100-Foot Journey. There are some lines open, so give us a call and talk to Richard. But 1-800-433-8850, drshow@wamu.org. But Richard, the first line of your book, I'm going to quote it here. The first, "I, Hassan Haji, was born the second of six children above my grandfather's restaurant on the Nepean Sea Road in what was then called West Bombay." How can you, as a half American, half Portuguese expat, start a novel saying, "I, Hassan Haji, who is an Indian Muslim"?
Great story. And you're really getting to what a great, great question. And you're really getting to what I think is the point of this book. Yes, it is about food, and it's about a road trip, but that is really on a rather superficial level. On a deeper level, it's really about finding your calling in life. When I couldn't get a publisher to look at me, I went to a top agent in New York, and I won't mention her name, and she said, "Why should we buy a book from you in the voice of an Indian when there's so many marvelous Indian writers around?" Not a invalid point. However, surely, what's the point of an imagination? I can only have an imagination in a certain box. The point was, it's like an actor. I once had the privilege of, for the New York Times, doing a film piece on Jeanne Moreau, the great French actress, and I went to visit her in her changing room in Paris in the theater, and she was telling me how she prepares for a role, and she does it through the costume. She first decides what the cost, you know, is, would this character wear a bracelet or a, you know, a frilly shirt, and that, and she builds the character from the outside in. Well, that's how, you know, great actors can do it. And so I set out to myself, and the public will decide if I achieved it, is to, can I do the same thing in fiction? Can I put on another character and be convincing that it is, that I am of Islamic descent and an Indian?
It sounds to me like the combination of your acting experience, which you connect to Jean Moreau, but also this very diverse and cosmopolitan background that you brought. It's almost as if the alienation and the lack of a secure identity makes it easier, not harder, for you to wear different clothes and different costumes.
I think you're absolutely right. And in fact, why I was Forbes's longest-serving European correspondent was that they could parachute me into any culture.
How many languages do you speak?
Well, I'm fluent in High German and Swiss German, and I fake a couple of others.
Not Portuguese?
Portuguese was my first language, but I've forgotten, out of lack of use, I've forgotten.
But then how did you, given all of the options, why did you pick a an Indian Muslim as your main character?
Well, as I said, I was deliberately to try and convince Ismail to make a film. So that was it. I had never been to India when I started writing this book. In the middle of it, I said, oops, it might be a good idea to go to India. So I convinced Forbes to send me to India for 10 days, where I did a couple of stories and I did some research. But you know, one of the log jams in my publishing, you know, this very circuitous route I took to get this book published, was that the Indians bought it first. And I did a book tour of India, and I got rave reviews there, and they were very, very generous to me. And they said, he nailed it. And that was the log – that cleared the log
jam. The calling card to
the
logic.
Yeah. So when I came back to America, they said, okay, we're convinced.
Richard Moraes, his book is his new novel, The 100-Foot Journey. Give us a call. I'll be talking to Richard. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. My guest this hour is Richard Moraes, formerly chief European correspondent for Forbes magazine, and now out with his first novel, The 100-Foot Journey, which is, as he was just describing, told in the voice of a Muslim from India who goes on a journey after having grown up in India. Give our readers a quick account of this journey, which then goes to London, a place you lived in for many years. And that period, pretty bleak. I mean, this family had a hard time in London.
They did. London is sort of a transition period, but it's a lot of people sort of gloss over it. But I personally think it's a very important part, because that is when there is a scene in particular where he meets a girl and he goes to a theater and he sees a play, and he bursts out in tears. And the play is about gays who have been exiled in Siberia during the Soviet era. And he realizes that the play is really not about gays. It's about people who have a calling that's at odds to their own family and culture. And yet, in order to become complete human beings, they have to fulfill their calling in life, whatever the consequences. And that is really what happens to Hassan. And so he bursts into tears. He doesn't know why. And this sort of turns on his girlfriend, and she takes him back to the apartment. But the point is that this London period is for those people who are looking for more than just the food. I think that writing is like conversation. In the course of a day, there are times when we have to be superficial and fun and have a hoot. But there are also times in during the course of the day where it's appropriate to be deep and profound.
But now Hassan grew up in a family with a food background.
Correct.
Grew up over this restaurant, smelling
Correct.
These smells. But what was it about his calling? What was it about his destiny that was at odds?
Well, his destiny is to become a great French chef. Which is sacrilegious to the father. So that is his destiny, and he sacrifices everything in order to meet this destiny that has just this calling that has just he was born with, and the whole story is about how he becomes one of the great French chefs.
And how does he acquire? You know, I've written a lot about immigration, and I've written a lot about people changing their lives. And it seems to me that often a journey like this starts with an act of imagination. How can you imagine yourself in a place different from where you are, with a personality or calling, as you put it, different? Where does that moment, that spark of imagination, come from? An Indian Muslim boy, how does he imagine himself as a French chef?
Again, a terrific question. I think it doesn't come in a moment. Uh-huh. I think it comes in little bits and pieces, sort of like they say enlightenment comes. You know, it's not something that you keep. It comes in bits and pieces. There are a couple of scenes, and as he progresses in his journey, he has these epiphanies, and the picture comes over time. And one of them is when they first arrive to Lumiere, which is where they settle in the Jura, in the Alps between France and Switzerland, in a little village opposite a two-star French restaurant. He's walking
and
home with his...
And that's the 100-foot journey those two restaurants.
And that's the 100-foot journey is the distance he has to travel from his family's, cheap, lively Indian restaurant to this very, prestigious two-star French restaurant. It's only 100 feet, but it's actually, he's striding from one end of the earth to the other.
Sure.
And but he has this one scene where he sees them butcher a pig, which, of course, for a Muslim is, revolting.
Yeah.
But inexplicably, he is absolutely drawn to the scene, and he has never seen anything so beautiful in his life as this pig butchering, where the entire village comes out and the priest is blessing the pig, and they slit its throat and they butcher it in the garden, and this is one of the scenes where he suddenly realizes slowly that he has a calling beyond his family and his culture.
Fascinating. I'm also interested in, as you point out from the very beginning, this film this book is in part crafted to be a film. You, in your own acknowledgement, you say this is an homage to Ismail Merchant. You even muse about who might play the parts, and it's been compared to Slumdog Millionaire as a story. I must say, the story I compared it to was Ratatouille, the story of the mouse who yearns to be this great French chef and eventually succeeds.
I was both horrified and pleasantly surprised that when I saw Ratatouille, because we had the same core, it was the same thing. This mouse has a calling, and even though he
beyond his own culture, mouse being a chef.
I mean,
that's even more of a stretch than a Hindu from India becoming a chef.
Well, it's been the elevator pitch for this is Slumdog Millionaire meets Chocolat, and that is part of the fun. Part of the joy about writing fiction is, you and I both have nonfiction backgrounds, but part of the joy of writing fiction is you have this huge canvas. You can go anywhere. And one of, I sit in my room in Philadelphia writing, but I'm actually, when I'm writing well, I'm actually in the markets in Paris or in the markets in Mumbai. I am totally transported. And, I mean, that is just incredible freedom and luxury. And it is part of that joy that I hope will come through in my novel.
You know, as you mentioned, all of the reviews, and you've gotten some wonderful reviews of this book, a lot of them do focus on the food aspect. And a lot of the folks who've commented on it, you know, right on the front cover, Anthony Bourdain, the famous chef, easily the best novel ever set in the world of cooking. But I'm also hearing from you that this book is also about families. It's not just about food. It's about families. It's about generations. It's about how you absorb the traditions and pay homage to the earlier generations and what they stood for, and then put your own stamp, your own character, your own identity in your own generation.
Absolutely. You know, the cliche about food writing is the sexual and sensual part. I deliberately didn't want to do that. Or, you know, although it's there, it's sort of in the background. The more important love relationships over the food is with family. And there is a scene. I got a lovely email from Chef Cardoz of Tabla, the great restaurant, Danny Meyer restaurant in New York. And Floyd Cardoz is going of Portuguese India. And he sent me this incredible email, and he's saying, Richard, and I had never met him until after I wrote my book and I gave him a copy. And he said, Richard, there are things in here, this is my story, there are things in here that no one knows about me, and it's as if I whispered them into your ear and you wrote them down. And of course, as a writer, you can imagine that was one of the greatest compliments I've ever received. And one of them is that he had this experience in my novel. Hasan Haji, his mother takes him out to a meal when he's a boy in Mumbai, and they go to a French restaurant, sort of a tatty French restaurant in Bombay, and something tragic happens to his mother later, and so this French meal with his mother is infused with all this emotion of the loveliness of his mother. And it is part of the reason why he has this calling. It is to recreate this moment he had with his mother.
You know, it's such an interesting point because so much of the food writing today, so much of the talk and the TV shows of about food, it's become such a huge industry. But a lot of it is on a level of showmanship. A lot of it is on the level of marketing. You know, the mm-hmm. famous chefs are now brand names. But for most of us, food is interconnected with family. It's not a restaurant experience so much as a home experience. And in many ways, the most memorable meals most of us have shared, it's not just about what we've eaten. It's who we've shared the meal with, who else has been sitting around the table, and who cooked it, and who served it, because food is a gift. Any cook will tell you that. Food is a gift to the loved ones or the customers that you prepare it for. And this book, I think, has that dimension to it. It's not just about the glitzy. There's a lot about 2 stars and 3 stars and the politics of that. But it comes back to this home-based, family-based essence.
I remember as a boy summering in Portugal with my family, and my father and his friend roasted a kid, and they dug a pit and put charcoals in, and they roasted a baby goat over a spit. It was such a memorable experience, and in fact, all the men in my family are great cooks, but we're entirely intuitive, and so I work very hard to get the technical aspects, because running a restaurant and you know all of that, that's a very different kind of category. But we're all intuitive cooks, and you're absolutely right that if I had my druthers of what I would want a reader to take away from this, it is precisely that point, is that it is the great love and affection that somehow mysteriously comes out from a shared meal with family or friends. And that is the underlying thread throughout the entire book.
We've got some listeners who want to share the conversation with Richard Moraes here. So let's start with Karen in Louisville, Kentucky. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. I'm just so excited. I turned my car on and turned on the radio, and I finished the 100-foot journey last evening. So this is just magical coincidence. And the 100-foot journey read to me almost like a fairy tale. Madame Mallory and Paul looking out for this man. So I'm just wondering if you would comment on that, but then also on what was the research that you did to get the food so right? Because you got the food in every cuisine just spot on. So I'll hang up and listen on the air.
Thank you so much for your call.
First of all, thank you so much. You can imagine it's very moving to hear a caller call in like that as a writer.
We try to help you out here on the Diane Sure.
The first thing, let me answer the second part of the question first as to the research. As I said, the men in my family are intuitive cooks. You know, we love to cook, but we're fakes. And you build these things up, and this is where my journalist training came in very mm-hmm. handy, is doing the research. And it's like a painting. You build it up bit by bit by bit by bit. So the first thing you do is you do enough research to try and get the voice so that you're convincing that I'm an Indian of Muslim descent. And luckily, because I was in London, I heard a lot of, you know, mm-hmm. Indian. And so that was okay. Then, as I said, I'd never been to India. So in the middle, I said, oops, let's go to India. And when I was doing this 10-day trip for Forbes, I went to Crawford Market. I asked some friends in Bombay, and they got me into Khyber, which is one of the great restaurants in Mumbai. And I spent a half day in their kitchen. When I was in London, for example, I love to salmon fish, and I go to Iceland salmon fishing, have since I was a boy. And I had this Icelandic friend, and he convinced me to go ptarmigan hunting with him in October once. And ptarmigan is the Arctic grouse that turns white when the snow mm-hmm. Comes. And it is the Christmas dish in Iceland. And so how they make that, how they make the bird for Christmas is they cut open the crop, which is the throat of the bird, and take some undigested herbs of the bird and make a sauce from the herbs that the bird itself has eaten. And there's a lot of my own experience with food, and then there's also a lot of technical research.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's talk to, by the way, we have some lines open. Call us 1-800-433-8850. Talk to Richard Moraes. Well, let's go to Marjorie in Birmingham, Alabama. Delighted to have you with us, Marjorie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm looking forward to reading the book. I really liked what you said a minute ago about reaching enlightenment in bits and pieces. And based on what you've been saying about the book, since I haven't read it, I'll have to anticipate. But it sounds, like a pretty spiritual book with the centrality of family and food, to humans since we evolved. That's part of our primeval heritage, and it is so central to our lives. Sorry, I'm breathless because I'm walking in the woods with my dogs. But anyway, the reason I called was I loved what you said to Grace Paley, and I'm dying to know how she responded.
She was shocked. And as you can imagine, it was really rather impertinent of me. But about 3 months later, her husband took me aside and said, "You're the one." I obviously had she had been mulling what I had told her, because she was a very decent soul and a real writer. But can I pick up on your point about the spiritual aspect? Thank you for asking that question. One of the main characters of my book is Madame Mallory, and she is the chef at the 2-star French restaurant across the street. And she is a perfectionist, and she spends her entire life, she's like what I call a culinary nun. She's devoted her entire life to getting 3 stars. And when the Indian family moves in across the street from her, it's her 65th birthday, and she realizes she's never going to get her 3rd star. And her first reaction is revulsion. She's this typical, everything is about good taste, and there's this loud, colorful but slightly obnoxious family across the street, and her reaction is to actually to destroy them. But she has a spiritual something spiritual happens to her, and she has a moment, And she has a change in heart, and she eventually takes in Hassan after trying to destroy him. And she is the one who sets him on the path to become a great French chef. So I yes, there is a great deal of spirituality. You know, I think any good writing has to be three-dimensional. You have to have, as I said, on one level, it's just a plot, you know, page turner, and then what, and then what, and then what, and funny and amusing. And but it also has to have depth, you know, to be a satisfying meal. You need to have different layers of flavors.
Well, thanks so much for your call,
Marjorie.
Enjoy your walk in the woods with the dogs.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, Marjorie.
Bye. This character, Madame Mallory, you mentioned there's been a lot of talk about the movies, and one of the issues has been who would play Madame Mallory, and you said, of course, Jean Moreau, you mentioned earlier, who an actress. You said maybe she's too old, but the universal feeling now seems to be it should be Meryl Streep.
Well, that would, of course. My wife would have to be holding onto my coattails and keep me on the earth if that happened.
Richard Moraes, his book is The 100-Foot Journey. We'll be right back with your calls and your comments. Tell us your stories about your food adventures. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at Hewlett.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Richard Cizik, former vice president of the National Association of Evangelicals. He was forced to resign after comments he made on our show in support of gay civil unions. We'll talk about how his life has changed and why he started a new evangelical group he sees as an alternative to evangelical groups that focus on the culture wars. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. My guest this hour, Richard C. Moraes, longtime foreign correspondent for Forbes magazine, based mainly in London, but traveled all over the world for Forbes, and now has poured a lot of his sensibilities as a foreign correspondent into his first novel. It's called The 100-Foot Journey, and it tells the story of a Muslim from India who journeys to London and then to France, where he sets up a restaurant and becomes a great French chef. Richard, I have a couple of emails that I'd like to read you. Eileen writes to us, looking forward to reading the book. Reminds me of when I lived in Paris in my 20s and dated a young Indian accountant. He seemed perfectly westernized in many ways, but when he went home for a visit one time with me and several others of his ex-girlfriends helping buy gifts for his family, he came back with a bride. First thing we knew about it was when a girl I worked with, wondering why he hadn't contacted her on his return, used the pretext of borrowing a cup of sugar to go to his apartment and see what was up. The very young bride opened the door. Anything like that in your book?
Terrific question. When I did the book tour of India, I was at this literary festival in Kerala, in southern India, and there was this marvelous Indian professor of literature, and he told this folk tale, Indian folk tale, about a boy in a village in the foothills of the Himalayas, and he's so tired of his village, and it smells of reeds, and he's just, it's Hicksville, and he just wants to get out, and he has this dream to go into the mountains, and his mother says, do not go into the mountains, do not go into the mountains, you will die if you go into the mountains. And but one day he can't stand it, and he goes into the mountains, and the tribe up in the mountains spot him, and they slaughter him. That's the folk tale. And I interpret that folktale as meaning is that there are certain people on earth who have to be attached to the soil from which they come from. They have to be attached to where, you know, their ancestors are buried. And if you take them out of that culture, they are become unstable people and die. And sadly, a lot of refugees in the world, that happens too. Conversely, I think there's another kind of person, and that kind of person has a calling or destiny, which can be at times at odds with their culture and their local village. And they have to go out into the world in order to become complete human beings. And so and if you force them to stay at home, they would then become unstable and die. And my book, it sounds like the email was about the former. He was on the superficially acclimatized.
Yeah, exactly.
But really, he was really still very attached. My book is really about someone who has the opposite.
And his romantic interest in the book is a French woman.
Correct. Right. Correct. So. Except in London, a very important one is that she is Indian.
Let's turn to some of our callers and Irfan, if I have your name correct, I hope.
Yes, sir.
From Boston. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks for taking my call. My comment was as if you guys are talking about my life. Because I'm a Muslim, mm-hmm. I'm Indian descent, mm-hmm. and I get engaged in London, and I'm settled in America.
Hello, brother.
So basically, it's kind of like, and when author is talking about the Crawford Market in Kerala, it just seems so moving and so connecting that I can actually feel my fingers tremoring right now, because that market feeling, I used to go out with my mother when I was little, and she would teach me what ingredients are, what kind of meat it is, mm-hmm. and this is how you cook it. So when he's talking about the character who moves to London, and he's a French culinary chef, and he has a calling to go all over the world, because that's how I feel. And I really appreciate that this story has been internationalized, because I always thought that there has to be someone out there who could put out my story.
Mm-hmm. I'm so moved by the caller. I just received an email from an Indian working for The Guardian in the UK, and it was exactly the same kind of story. I also think is that, you know, I chose for very self-serving reasons because of Ismail to make this an Indian, but I also think you can experience this from going from New Jersey to L.A. The Portuguese have this marvelous word saudade, and saudade is what is expressed in the Portuguese blues fados, and it is a yearning to get back to a kind of, and it's not a real place, it's kind of a mythic place of your home and your childhood. And so most of us are very confused. The French have a marvelous word, déraciné, which means it's sort of mixed races, and which is most of us are these days. I mean, let's face it, the world's become so mobile. And I think this is one of the great themes of the 21st century is you know, how, if we are of so mixed cultural heritage, how do we find our calling? How do we find our meaning in our life?
Sure. Irfan, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate
it. Thank you so much for taking my call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You know, and but you posit two extremes, but for many people, they're really a combination of those two. In a book I did last year about immigrants to America, there's a Indian family, mm-hmm. And this woman was in America. She was in college. She dropped out. She was in arranged marriage. She was a Brahmin from West Bengal. Her husband was a PhD from Case Western, right? Finally got his PhD, went looking for a bride. Where did he go? He didn't go back to India. He went to Queens, mm-hmm. you know, the next best thing. So she drops out of school, never becomes a doctor, and says to her two daughters, don't do what I did. Be an American. Be an independent woman. Get your degrees. Get your credentials. Get your own source of income. And marry Brahmins from West Bengal. So people can be mixtures of the traditional and the modern and recreate themselves. And each story is different. Each mixture is different. Each profile is different.
Absolutely. And Steve and I, we were talking before we went on the air. It's that it often takes several generations of the story to be told. And that the story always does. That's a very good point. And each new generation, I mean, to me, you know, everything is an untold story. It's a story in process. And the same thing goes with each generation picks up where the last chapter and continues to write the story. And you're absolutely right. I mean, if there's anything about the book, it is about the diversity. There is 1,001 ways to write this story, or a family to write their story, and it is usually like you're cooking a meal. You know, some people prefer more pepper, and some people prefer more cardamom, right. And it's how you put the mixture together.
Let's turn to Laverne in Hendersonville, North Carolina. Laverne, welcome on the Diane Rehm Show. We're happy to have you this morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, I did an ancestral cookbook for my family this Christmas, and what he says about the love, I haven't read the book yet, but I'm looking forward to it, about this book being the love story being about family and our family relationships to food, because something I never really appreciated till I did that, I was taking recipes from my grandparents and stuff, is that all of our recipes are from people that we love, either our friends or our families. Because all of those recipes that I had were from not only from mother to daughter, but also from cousin and aunts and just friends. And our food is all about relationship.
Right on. I mean, you know, you're hitting the nail on the head. In the end of the book, when he gets his three stars and he hangs the clip of his third star on the wall, he says he hangs it in that hungry space of generations ago. So it's just what you're saying, is that food, family over several generations, and the reinventing of the old family recipes, it is a continuum that I think is just it's a universal element. I mean, and that's where, whether it's French or Indian or, you know, WASP in New York or, you know, Baptist from Alabama, doesn't really...
Or Hendersonville, exactly. North Carolina, like Laverne.
it doesn't really matter, because it is the same universal element we're talking about.
And, you know, Laverne, I bet this is true for your family. I'm willing to bet this, that in addition to the recipes that were passed down, the other thing that is so central is the utensils. You know, cookingware.
Oh, yes.
The pots, and particularly the pots that have been used for generations, seasoned by all of those recipes and all of those cooks that went before you, those can
iron frying pans.
Yeah, they can be a very important part of this legacy too.
Or I would even add how you crush garlic, or certain techniques of the kitchen that are passed on in the family. You know, some people, you know, they squash the garlic with the knife, the flat knife, and so the skin comes off. And others, you know, precisely peel off the ends. I notice that in my family, there's like certain family quirks, and they've been passed on, you know, on how you cut certain things in the kitchen, and it's not just the utensils.
Right. Laverne, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed it. I want to get to a couple of more callers here. It's got a lot of people want to. Let's go to Lee in Greensboro, North Carolina. He's got a different point of view. Please go ahead. Lee, Greensboro, North Carolina, you're on the air. All right, we'll have to go to Lydia in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome.
Hi, it's Linda.
Linda, yes. Delighted to have you, Linda.
Thank you. I have two basic categories of a question. The first one is about the meal, the importance of the meal with family and friends. And I'm past Medicare age, but never in my family ever was there a situation where we enjoyed a meal together for various reasons? Never. And I wondered how the author would see that or relate to that when you talk about with family and friends.
Linda, I think you're not alone in these busy times and hard times that we live in. Several families have that experience. They eat at different times. I personally, one of the reasons I refused to go to an office when I worked for Forbes was that I didn't mind traveling, but I insisted that when I was home that I have my lunch and dinner with my family. And for me, that was very important. There's lots of people like you out there, Linda, but it's not my particular, frame of reference.
And it's never too late.
I think you misunderstood me. I'm not talking about how busy we are, and you don't even have to answer this, but we did sit down together.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said we never enjoyed.
Okay. I've been studying Buddhism for a long time, and two of the most important things that they talk about are nutrition and mental health. And I was talking about being there all together and it not being a good experience at all, ever.
Thank you very much, Linda. We really appreciate the call. I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's see who else we can find here who's been waiting a long time. Tony in Waterford, Michigan. Welcome. You're on The Diane Rehm Show, Tony.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, Richard. I wanted to relate my story. I grew up in a small town outside of Pittsburgh, and my grandparents on my dad's side are from Italy, and my grandparents on my mother's side are from Croatia. Mm-hmm. So there was an interesting cultural mix. When I was a child...
Good food on both sides of the family.
Let me add, my wife is Czech and Italian, so we're Paisan.
Yeah, and I'm an Eastern European Jew married to a Southern Catholic. So go ahead. You're among friends, Tony.
Okay, good. And I also relate with you as far as knowing I'm one of those people who are like you, that I, in order to be fulfilled, I needed to move away from my roots. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I'm only 5 hours away, so I'm there quite often. At any rate, when I was a kid growing up, I had an interesting cultural experience with food. My mother would, when I was working as a teenager and I'd come home for lunch, my mother would make me a standard American lunch with soup and sandwich and that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And I'd eat that big lunch, and then after that lunch was over, I would go up to my Italian grandmother's house and over there I had the big full-blown Italian lunch.
Every day a man after Italian my own heart. A great story.
Thank you so much, Tony. We have time. We got Lee back on the phone. So Lee in Greensboro, North Carolina. Sorry we dropped your call. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm Greek. My dad owned a restaurant. My grandfather owned a restaurant, and so it's kind of in the blood. But earlier you made the comment that people that enjoy cooking, it is expressed as a gift mm-hmm. to people, and I think that's what pulls them to it. It's a spiritual gift mm-hmm. of service, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. so I enjoyed that comment, and I enjoyed, I'm looking forward to reading his book, because there is my view of food is it's a passion. I think it's a
Lee, thank you so much for the comment. My Portuguese grandfather ran a restaurant. And I also think that is part of my untold family story, that somehow this restaurant that my great-grandfather has popped up four generations later in my food obsession. it is a mystery how these things continue.
Thank you, Lee, for your call. We really appreciate it. I must say that having explored immigrant families, one of the things I find that the restaurant business is so hard. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. take so much time. I have a Greek family in my book that runs a restaurant outside of Baltimore, the Towson Diner. They don't want their kids in it.
Right.
Because it's too hard.
Well, one of the sacrifices that Hasan Haji has to make is that he devotes himself so to his calling that he doesn't have a family at the end. And he realizes that that's one of the things that he sacrificed.
Very quickly. You love to cook. Mm-hmm. It's a nice weekend afternoon. It's noon. If you were cooking us lunch, what would you cook?
One of my favorites for the summer is rabbit, and I marinate it in white wine and mustard and bay leaf and garlic and then put it on the grill, and it is so good for you and so delicious. And with a salad and a glass of rosé wine, that's heaven on earth.
Are you inviting us?
Yeah. You got a rain check. I know you're traveling. Come up to Philadelphia, Steve, and you got it. You got the rabbit on the table.
That's pretty enticing. Richard Moraes. His book is The 100-Foot Journey. It's his first novel, and we're delighted that you were with us here on the Diane Rehm Show this morning.
I can't tell you how much fun and pleasure this was. It's really an honor.
Great, and we particularly appreciate all of those listeners who shared their stories, many we didn't get to, but I hope you enjoyed this hour with Richard. I did, and thanks for spending an hour with us this morning.
Thank you.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.